Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. This is episode 270 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. And in this podcast, I'll be continuing the rapid review series for the USMLE Step 2 CK exam. This is actually going to be series 43. And really, into this podcast, one thing I want to focus on are just like weird stuff that you don't see covered in many resources, but they end up being unusually high yield for purposes of the Step 2 CK and Step 3 exams. They just pop up a lot. So I'll just encourage you, really pay attention here. This is probably one of those ones you probably want to take notes with, because there's just many things that I will discuss here that you may not necessarily have heard of before, right? Or like there are subtle differences you may not think about. But those things, you see some of these MBME questions, you're like, why is the answer this way? I've never thought about it this way. Again, that's something you want to know. And then for those of you that are taking Step 2 CK anytime soon, I am offering a Step 2 CK class, like a series of classes from the 5th to the 7th of November, right? So on the 5th, we have the Test Taking Strategies class. And that Test Taking Strategies class is going to be from 2 to 4:30 Mountain Standard Time. So that's 2 hours behind Eastern Time. And basically, we'll use, again, a bunch of well-written questions to buttress test-taking strategies that are helpful for the USMLE exams, especially Step 2 CK and Step 3. And then on the 6th and the 7th of November, from noon to from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. Mountain Standard Time, so that's, again, 2 hours behind Eastern Standard Time, we'll have the 10-hour course. It will just basically be split into 2 days. And we'll cover about 800 concepts from all the disciplines, right? So PEDS, surgery, IM, OB-GYN, psych, neuro, over that period. Again, tons of people have taken this course. Tons of people have found it to be very useful. I have like a very large list of people that have done really well on their Step 2 CK exams after taking this course. So if it's something you're interested in, just shoot me an email and I'll be happy to point you in the right direction. So what if they give you a question about like a soldier or, you know, like an athlete that was maybe running in a running around in a 100 degree day or something like that, let's say like in Arizona or Texas or New Mexico or something like that, and then they tell you that this person has altered mental status, is confused, doesn't know where he is, and this person's temperature is like 104, what should you be thinking about under those circumstances? I would really hope you're thinking about a heat stroke, right? I would really hope you're thinking about a heat stroke. A heat stroke, it's something that can happen in many different settings, right? But classically, it'll be a person that's murking around outside on a very hot day, right? It can be a soldier, it can be an athlete. And typically, when a person gets heat stroke from this kind of cause, right? Because if you notice, the person was engaging in some kind of physical activity before they got into trouble. Whenever you see a person having heat stroke from like some kind of physical activity, I would strongly encourage you to consider treating them with like immersion in ice water. Right? Immersing those people in ice water is usually the prudent thing to do on MBME exams. And one thing that people routinely ask me is, Divine, how do I differentiate between a heat stroke and heat exhaustion? The way you differentiate between both pathologies is, people that have heat stroke, look at the name, it has a stroke in the name. They usually have altered mental status in the question. People that have heat exhaustion, they usually don't have altered mental status in the question. Again, that's not a set in stone difference, but it's a difference that often helps you pick one apart from the other on an MBME exam. So you may be like, okay, Divine, why are you highlighting all this physical activity and saying, oh, if you see a person having a heat stroke from physical activity, you should treat them with ice water immersion? Well, let me explain. There are other things that can cause heat stroke that do not involve you engaging in physical activity, right? So for example, if a person is taking like over-the-counter cold medication, basically diphenhydramine, remember, that can exert an anticholinergic effect, right? Also, remember some of these sympathomimetic drugs, right? So some of these drugs that have produced like adrenergic tone, some of these pressors, they can absolutely cause hyperthermia, right? And again, that should make sense because these drugs in some situations can increase your metabolic rate, right? Remember, fight or flight response, so they can absolutely cause those kinds of problems, right? And also sometimes diuretics in some cases, because again, if you're dried out, you're almost not able to distribute fluid very nicely around the body, right? So those things can all cause heat strokes, right? But you're not engaging in any kind of physical activity when you arrive at those kinds of problems, right? So whenever you see stuff like this, and usually it'll be in an old person, because who are the people that take pressors, like usually super sick in the hospital, or who are the people that are taking anticholinergics and all that stuff? It's going to be an old person, right? And again, these people, they will have the altered mental status, they will have the high fevers. But in this case, you want to actually cool these people down with evaporative cooling mechanisms, right? You basically want to cool them from an external perspective, right? So like evaporative cooling, or, you know, you can put them on a fan, under like a fan or something like that. But in general, again, when physical activity is not involved, again, I know you may be like, Divine, I don't care about this thing you're saying. I promise you, you will care if you see it on an NBM exam. When a person has a heat stroke from taking like some kind of medication, you want to use evaporative cooling techniques. For a person that has heat stroke from physical exertion, you absolutely want to immerse those people in ice water, right? Immersing people in ice water that have like anticholinergic toxicity as the cause of their heat stroke is contraindicated on NBM exams. Again, very high yield to know that. Again, it's a subtle difference, but I promise you, this is something that, especially the newer NBM exams, like the stuff from 2020, they love this concept a ton, right? And then what if they give you a question about a patient and they tell you that this patient, you know, had to be paralyzed, right, for surgical procedure, and then they notice that during the course of the procedure, the patient is becoming harder and harder to ventilate, the patient's PCO2 is going up, right? And then they tell you that the patient has like a leukocytosis, right, and again has a very high fever. If you see stuff like that, right, you absolutely want to think about what? You want to think about malignant hyperthermia, right? Remember, malignant hyperthermia, it's actually an autosomal dominant disorder. And usually it arises from mutations in calcium channels, right? So it can usually be like the ryanodine receptor, right? So remember, that's a calcium channel. And in some cases, it can also be the dihydropyridine receptor. But usually it's a ryanodine receptor mutation that causes malignant hyperthermia. And again, what's the thing that puts you in that position, right? If you're exposed to like anesthetic, right? So like if you're exposed to like all these inhaled anesthetics, I mean, all these volatile anesthetics like halothane, although no one uses halothane anymore. Probably like in some developing countries, they still do that. But for the most part in the US, you don't really find that anywhere anymore, right? Or, you know, stuff like isoflurane, all those anesthetics that end in ane, right? And also don't forget succinylcholine. Succinylcholine can absolutely trigger, malignant hyperthermia on an NBM exam, right? So again, classic presentation, high fever, leukocytosis. The person will have an increase in PCO2. They can make it like a surgery question where the person is becoming hard to ventilate a few minutes to hours after the surgery was started. If you see that, you think about malignant hyperthermia. And again, you want to go ahead and stop the drug, right? Remember, if a person is suffering toxicity from any drug, the first thing you always want to do is go ahead and stop that drug, right? You don't want to be giving someone something that's kind of crushing their lives, right? So you stop the drug. And then the other thing you want to do on an NBM exam is to give them dantrolene, right? Remember, dantrolene is a ryanodine receptor antagonist. Although if your friends at the NBM wanted to get cute, instead of putting dantrolene as an answer, what they will do is they will put calcium channel blocker as an answer, because it's a ryanodine receptor antagonist, and the ryanodine receptor is a calcium channel, okay? So it's a ryanodine receptor antagonist that's very awesome for the treatment of malignant hyperthermia. And one thing your friends at the NBME can do with malignant hyperthermia is they can ask, which of the following represents the most likely electrolyte abnormality in this patient? I would hope you're telling me that it's going to be hyperkalemia, right? Because these people, they're having a lot of death of muscle cells. As those muscle cells die, right, they're going to release their cell soup into the surroundings, right? That's going to be hyperkalemia. So again, in some cases, they can literally give you a hyperkalemia question in the context of malignant hyperthermia. Obviously, you're going to give those people calcium gluconate first, you know, to stabilize the myocardium. You're going to give them insulin plus glucose, right? So that you can drive potassium into cells. You want to give them like sodium bicarbonate, because that will create a metabolic alkalosis that will draw hydrogen ions out of cells. Potassium will go in reverse. You can give them a beta-2 agonist like albuterol, right? That can again increase the activity of the sodium potassium ATPase pump. And that will drive, because remember, the sodium potassium ATPase pump gets 3 sodiums out of cells and puts 2 potassium into cells, right? So you can give them that albuterol, beta-2 agonist. It increases the activity of the sodium potassium ATPase pump that will drive potassium into cells, and that will help those patients, right? And also that insulin plus glucose business. Remember, insulin loves to activate things, right? You can activate the sodium potassium ATPase pump and also give you a similar effect, right? And also remember, you can potentially give these people like vigorous fluids, right? And then accompany that with furosemide, right? So you're giving them a ton of fluid. That fluid will cause them to pee a lot. And if you're giving them furosemide, you can accelerate the rate of that pee. Because remember, furosemide is a loop diuretic, and loop diuretics cause you to dump a ton of, because they make you volume depleted, they increase the activity of your renin angiotensin aldosterone system, right? And aldosterone, if you remember the principal cell of the collecting duct, it'll cause you to dump potassiums in your urine, right? So you can essentially get like a potassium diuresis that way. Another thing you can also do, obviously, in hyperkalemia, right, is you can give K-exalate, right? Remember, K-exalate makes K exit out of the body, right? So it's sometimes you may see it, instead of calling it K-exalate on an exam to mess with your head, they can call it sodium polystyrene sulfonate, right? I'll say that again, sodium polystyrene sulfonate, right? So it's a potassium binding resin, it binds up the potassium and you pop it out safely. Although remember, it actually increases a person's risk of bowel necrosis. That's why they're beginning to think twice about using it in many hospitals across the U.S. And then remember that people that have malignant hyperthermia, these people can absolutely get rhabdomyolysis, right? They can get rhabdomyolysis. They can, if you see a rising creatinine in the setting of malignant hyperthermia, right, it's going to be myoglobin that's collecting in those people's urine, causing an acute tubular necrosis, right? Essentially just crushing these people's renal tubules. Again, this is one of those reasons why giving a ton of fluid is very helpful in these people, right? Giving a ton of fluid is extremely helpful in these people because you are washing away that myoglobin in those circumstances. And then please also do not forget, it is actually important to remember the findings in the urine, right? In a person that has rhabdomyolysis, remember they will have this thing where you're looking at the urine, you're like, ooh, this urine has 4+ blood, right? But then you notice you're like seeing like 0 to 2 or 3 red blood cells per high power field. That makes absolutely no sense. If a person has like 4+ blood in the urine, you're going to be seeing like a ton of red blood cells. You're going to be seeing like 50 to 100 red blood cells per high power field, right? So if you're seeing 4+ blood, but you're not seeing a commensurate number of red blood cells per high power field, then that should tell you that you're very, 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 very likely dealing with some kind of rhabdomyolysis, right? In fact, to be honest with you, I think of rhabdomyolysis as almost like the albuminocytologic dissociation of the urine. Remember, albuminocytologic dissociation is a phenomenon that we find with Guillain-Barré syndrome, right? But in Guillain-Barré syndrome, the thing we notice is that the person's, you check their CSF, and you'll find that you'll find a ton of protein, right? But normally when you see a ton of protein, you should find a lot of white blood cells, right? So if you're seeing a ton of protein, like 5+ protein in the CSF, and then you're seeing again 0 to 2 white blood cells per high power field, that makes no sense, right? So there's a dissociation between the protein counts, that's the albumino part of things, and the white blood cell counts, that's the cyto part of things, right? So that's like albumino cytologic dissociation, right? So that's what we find with Guillain-Barré syndrome. We find an analogous thing, right, in a person that has but this time it concerns blood and red blood cells in the urine of a person that has a rhabdomyolysis. And then what if they give you a question about a patient and they tell you that this patient, you know, has a history of like diabetic gastroparesis, person was recently started on a drug, and then now this person has like, it's like confused, has altered mental status, has like a ton of muscle rigidity, is super tachycardic, has a very high blood pressure, right? And they tell you that this person has no myoclonus, right? And this person's deep tendon reflexes are decreased. Pay attention to that decreased deep tendon reflexes. If you see this, what do you want to think about? Well, I would hope you're telling me that this person likely has NMS, right? So this person almost certainly has some kind of neuroleptic malignant syndrome, right? So neuroleptic malignant syndrome, remember, it's something that can happen when you're exposed to a drug that blocks dopamine receptors, right? Although there is one new scenario that your friends at the MBMEs have started going after. I'll talk about that in a second. But basically, this person has diabetic gastroparesis. Obviously, you're given a prokinetic agent like metoclopramide. So metoclopramide, right, is a dopamine receptor antagonist, right? So it can absolutely cause neuroleptic malignant syndrome. The key thing that you'll find in that helps you differentiate NMS from malignant hyperthermia is the predisposing factor, right? People that have NMS, these are people that have taken, you'll see a temporal association with exposure to some kind of dopamine blocker, some kind of antipsychotic, right? So like olanzapine, haloperidol, quetiapine, stuff like that, right? But in malignant hyperthermia, the exposure will be to some anesthetic-based agent, right? Again, all those fluorines, succinylcholine, things like that. Now, the one weird exposure that you may see, especially on the newer MBMEs, in a person that has NMS, it will not be a person that has taken any kind of dopamine antagonist, but it will be a person that is withdrawing from exposure to a dopaminergic agent. Let me give you an example, right? So they can give you an NMS question in a person that is being treated for Parkinson's disease, right? What do I mean by that? So let's say, for example, a person is, you know, taking carbidopa, levodopa for Parkinson's, and then for some reason, the person is not able to fill their prescription. And then they've not taken their medications for like 2 weeks. And then they tell you that this person has a leukocytosis, has muscle rigidity and all that stuff. If you see that, you absolutely want to think about NMS, right? You absolutely want to think about NMS. And again, how do you treat NMS? Stop the badness, right? Stop the bad drug that's causing their problems, right? And go ahead and give those people dantrolene. Again, don't forget that ryanodine receptor antagonist, although NMS is not a genetic condition, unlike malignant hyperthermia in general. I will just say that in general, right? So for NMS, you're going to give dantrolene. And then usually you can also give a dopamine agonist, right? So you can give something like bromocriptine or cabergoline, right? Although, pick dantrolene first as treatment. If you don't see that, then you can go ahead and give like a dopamine agonist. If you don't see a dopamine agonist as an answer, you can give a benzodiazepine, right? And then remember something that may look a lot like NMS is serotonin syndrome, right? And again, serotonin syndrome can have many triggers on MBM exams. Basically, they'll give you a bunch of drugs that can cause those problems, right? So like SSRIs, right? SNRIs, right? So remember your SNRIs like venlafaxine, duloxetine, milnacipran, desvenlafaxine, right? Don't forget your linezolid. Linezolid is an antibiotic that's used to treat MRSA, right? But remember that it also has some weak monoamine oxidase inhibitor properties, so it can absolutely cause serotonin syndrome. Don't forget sumatriptan, your migraine meds, they are serotonergic agents, right? They are serotonin receptor agonists, so they can absolutely cause those kinds of problems. And then also don't forget like some of these herbal preparations like St. John's wort. St. John's wort basically is an SSRI, right? So it absolutely has serotonergic properties. It can cause serotonin syndrome. Another classic drug you may see on your exam is MDMA, ecstasy, right? Ecstasy is a serotonergic agent, so they can make a serotonin syndrome question based on that. And then also don't forget your other psych medications, right? So like TCAs, your tricyclic antidepressants, don't forget your MAOIs, your monoamine oxidase inhibitors, right? So drugs like phenelzine, tranexamic acid, isocarboxazid, right? Those are all examples of monoamine oxidase inhibitors. Those things can all trigger serotonin syndrome. And the thing is, many people are classically used to seeing that, oh, you're on two serotonergic agents, so it causes problems. Fine, whatever. But the thing is, your friends at the MBME, they're getting smarter. So what do they do these days? They will give you a question about a person that's taking like one serotonergic agent, but they recently just discontinued another serotonergic agent. Again, if you see that, that can predispose a person to getting serotonin syndrome. I mean, like, for example, if you're taking an SSRI or an SNRI, you're supposed to wait for 2 weeks. If you stop those drugs, you're supposed to wait for 2 weeks before you start a patient on like a TCA or an MAOI. If not, you are raising that patient's risk of serotonin syndrome. And one key critical thing, actually, that will help you differentiate between NMS and serotonin syndrome on MBM exams is people that have NMS, they have no myoclonus. But people that have serotonin syndrome will have myoclonus. People that have NMS, they will have a decrease in their deep tendon reflexes. But people that have serotonin syndrome, they will have an increase in their deep tendon reflexes. So basically, just think of it as the double negative for NMS and the double positive for serotonin syndrome. The double negative for NMS is the absence of myoclonus and a decrease in deep tendon reflexes. The double positive for serotonin syndrome is the presence of myoclonus and an increase in deep tendon reflexes. And in general, when a person has serotonin syndrome, again, go ahead and stop the offending agents, right? But actually, serotonin syndrome, the first line treatment for serotonin syndrome on MBM exams is a benzodiazepine. This is super high yield to know. The first line treatment for serotonin syndrome on an MBM exam is a benzodiazepine, right? So if they give you a benzodiazepine as an answer and ciproheptadine as an answer, pick a benzodiazepine over ciproheptadine. The only time you should pick ciproheptadine is if a benzodiazepine is not given as an answer choice. Again, you may be like, Divine, it's kind of weird. I'm not buying what you're saying. I promise you, you really should buy everything I'm selling right now. It's extremely high yield to know this stuff, especially for the newer exams. If you remember, if you compare, because again, right, this is one of those things that you pick up on as a tutor and as a teacher for a long period of time, right? I mean, I've been making podcasts now for quite a while, right? So the thing is, the character of MBM exams between 2017 to 2019 is vastly different from the character of MBM exams in 2020. The MBM exams in 2020, they test the same pathologies that you're used to, but they test more subtle things with those pathologies. And they're letting go essentially of all these buzzwords. And they are giving you, they're beginning to give more descriptions of these buzzwords or unusual presentations of common pathologies that you've previously learned. Because other than like these risk factors, prognostic factors, most common causes of death, and all the stuff with the military and healthcare systems, the NBM is still testing the exact same knowledge. They're just testing it in new ways, right? So again, when you see me emphasize unusual presentations of things, pay special attention to those things, because those things in general are very high yield to know for purposes of exams. And I'm going to be rounding up soon since this is a rapid review series, right? But so what are some things I think I want to throw in here, right? So again, let me talk about some quick hypertensive syndromes, like some quick, let me call them almost like acute hypertensive syndromes that you should recognize and be able to treat on an NBM exam, right? So obviously, they give you a question about a person that has a history of Marfan's, right? Or a history of like Turner syndrome. And then this person has like sudden onset severe chest pain, right? And the person is very hypertensive. If you see that, I would really hope that you're thinking about aortic dissection. Remember, aortic dissection, what do you always want to give those people? You want to give them a beta blocker first, right? You can give them any kind of beta blocker. You can even give labetalol, which is an alpha beta blocker, right? So you give them a beta blocker. A classic fake out answer on NBM exams is hydralazine. Never pick hydralazine for aortic dissection. It worsens morbidity in aortic dissection. If you pick that answer, I guarantee you will get it wrong, right? There are many studies that have proven that hydralazine is an awful option in a person that's been treated for aortic dissection, right? And then, what if they give you a question about a patient, and a patient is going through like some kind of CHF exacerbation, right? If a person is going through like a CHF exacerbation, and you know they have like pulmonary edema and they are hypertensive. If you're seeing hypertension in the setting of a CHF exacerbation, what kind of drug do you want to give those people? You want to give them something like nitroglycerin, you want to give them something like nitroprusside, right? Those things will help in those circumstances. Why? Well, those things are venodilators, right? So because they are venodilators, they're going to pull that blood in the legs where it won't kill you, right? And take it away from the lungs where it will kill you, right? So you give, again, a nitrate-based compound. Those are venodilators, right? And those things will also decrease myocardial oxygen demand, right? So you give nitroglycerin or nitroprusside in those circumstances, right? And then if a person is very hypertensive, right? And let's say those people have like, they have like very thick skin, they have like a long history of GERD, obviously that person has scleroderma renal crisis, right? When a person has scleroderma renal crisis, you absolutely want to give those people like an ACE inhibitor or an ER, like, or an ARBS treatment, but first line should be an ACE inhibitor, enalapril, lisinopril, stuff like that, right? And then if a person has a hypertensive emergency, and let's say these people, they tell you that this person, you know, has a history of atypical depression or started on a new drug and then started having like altered mental status at a restaurant, and then the person's blood pressure is like 250 over 130, like crazy high blood pressure. If you see that, right, you're thinking about some kind of thyramine food crisis, right? If you see the thyramine hypertensive crisis, because remember, thyramine is a sympathomimetic, it's broken down by monoamine oxidase, right? So if a person is on an MAOI, again, something like tranexamic or isocarboxazid or phenylzine, that's going to inhibit MAOI. If MAOI is taken out of commission, then guess what? You're not going to be able to break down or, you know, metabolize tyramine, right? So tyramine will go and do its sympathomimetic stuff, and that can cause some pretty significant problems for the patient, right? That can cause some pretty significant problems for the patient. So just, again, something you want to keep at the back of your mind for these exams, right? So when a person has that kind of situation, you want to give that person phentolamine. Phentolamine is the drug of choice in those circumstances, although you can also use nitroprusside. But almost certainly, the first thing you'll likely see on an NBM exam is phentolamine. Phentolamine is a reversible, non-selective alpha blocker, right, that can help with treating those kinds of hypertensive emergencies. And then obviously, if a person has hypertension in pregnancy or some kind of hypertensive emergency in pregnancy, you know, usually in the setting of like preeclampsia or eclampsia, what do you want to give those people? Typically on NBM exams, you want to give those people like labetalol. Huh? You can give labetalol, you can give nicardipine, or you can give hydralazine, right? This is one of those rare hypertensive emergency problems where giving hydralazine is fine, okay? Pregnant women, hypertension, preeclampsia, eclampsia, if you're trying to cut down their blood pressure, go ahead and give those people hydralazine, right, or labetalol or nicardipine, right? Remember, you cannot give ACE inhibitors or ARBs to pregnant people, or those direct renin inhibitors, like, so drugs like alisprin, for example, you can do that, right? Or nitroprusside. Those things are bad for the baby, right? So you don't want to give those things under those circumstances, right? So, I think I'm going to go ahead and stop here. So thank you for listening. I hope you find this to be helpful. For those of you that, again, are going through the U.S. process, I wish you all the very best. If you need help with mock interviews, feel free to reach out to me. And then please subscribe to the website, right? It's a WordPress website, divineinterventionpodcasts.com. And then I also have a YouTube channel, Divine Intervention USMLE Podcasts and Videos, right? So please subscribe to that. And then I also have this podcast on Apple Podcasts, on Google Play. I think it's now called Google Podcasts, and also Spotify, right? So, you know, please subscribe, leave any feedback. It's always helpful. And then one other thing I think I want to mention is the most recent 150 podcasts I make are the things you'll find on the podcast apps. If you want to find all the podcasts, including the old ones, go to the website, right? It's something that's completely out of my hands. It's like a WordPress rule, essentially, that I cannot circumvent. Trust me, I've tried. So thank you for listening. God bless you and have a wonderful evening. I'll see you next time. Thank you.